This is Artistic Director Martha Levy, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Audio Program. Steppenwolf Theatre Company presents A Parallelogram by Bruce Norris, directed by ensemble member Anna Shapiro, featuring ensemble members Kate Arrington and Tom Irwin, with Mary Louise Burke and Tim Bickle. We conclude our season of belief with Bruce Norris's play, A Parallelogram. Over the course of the season, we have watched the characters in these various plays construct narratives to support their version of reality. The stories these characters tell themselves, the stories we tell ourselves, are grounded in a leap of faith, a belief, to account for the unknowns that are constituent to our human condition. Belief, however unconsciously carried, is our necessity. Mortality is our limit. Consciousness of our mortality is our anxiety. How to make our lives livable as we approach the unknown? Belief. We've watched those self-narratives in conflict. In Fake, a collision of the scientific, the religious, the personal. In American Buffalo, the collision of social force with personal myth. In the brother-sister plays, a collision of the communal narrative with the process of individuation. In Endgame, a confrontation with death in the absence of any overarching narrative. And so, too, A Parallelogram. One of the things the play brings first to mind is the credo that to see is to believe. The idea that our beliefs are guided by evidence available to us through our vision. I'll believe it when I see it. I recently heard the counter to this statement. We see what we believe. This seeing is believing, believing is seeing dynamic is central to A Parallelogram. B, a woman in her early 30s, sees a character that no one else in the play can see, designated as B2. She converses with B2, who seems to be some future version of herself. B2 explains her presence by describing a phenomenon of the physical universe that she calls a parallelogram, based on Einstein's assertion that there is a space-time continuum, that there are multiple infinite universes, and that there are infinite spatial points at which all events of one's life happen simultaneously. The younger B is resistant. If her future self exists simultaneously with her present self, does that mean her present-day actions cannot change the course of her life? The deft move that Bruce makes in the creation of B2 is that we see what B sees. B2 has a reality for us because we see her on stage. There she is. The inability of other characters in the play to see B2 seems their limitation. We are made complicit in B's version of reality. We believe her because we see what she sees. B sits at the center of the play, literally. She sits on her bed, and the world moves around her. The story issues from B's point of view. She is, in that sense, the play's narrator, and in her, Bruce has created a character whose reliability is uncertain. On the one hand, she seems the clear-eyed party in her relationship. Jay's treatment of JJ, his yelling into the television while a football game proceeds, his testy conversation with his child from a failed marriage, all point toward a limited view. On the other hand, we begin to discover B's history and suspect that she may be an unreliable narrator. I think of Wallace Shawn's Aunt Dan and Lemon. Like Lemon, the narrator of that play, B is visioned as an ailing character. B is in bed throughout, and in both plays, the memories and projections emerge from the vision of these persuasive but perhaps unwell women. In both plays, the audience is invited into an identification with the narrative voice and only incrementally begins to question the angle of vision they offer. I resist the temptation to describe more completely the turns in the narrative and the revelations that emerge in B's story because a good part of the pleasure in the play comes from the audience's opportunity for their own time travel, to loop back to the beginning of the play and put the puzzle pieces together. Bruce enjoys a twisty tale. His creation of one is, I think, part of the underlying motive of the play. A parallelogram asks us to investigate our assumptions, our beliefs, about the logic of our own lives. Is our will determinant of our fate? Is our end forewritten? Can the narrative be interrupted and turned another way? Can we control the course of our lives? And do we want to? Bruce has set a parallelogram in the realm of interpersonal relationships. This is a return to the landscape of some of his earlier plays, The Infidel and Purple Heart. The plays that followed were more explicitly centered in the socio-political realm, The Pain and the Itch, The Unmentionables, Clybourne Park. When asked about this shift, Bruce has said that he didn't set out to be a social satirist, but the political situation in the United States at the beginning of the 21st century made it necessary to speak directly to the world. I don't think a parallelogram is without political content, however. Bruce's eye for the way in which the choices we make in our personal lives have political impact is keen. Our beliefs about how we can or cannot control our own destiny are germane to the decisions we make about how to interact with the world. A parallelogram in the guise of a witty domestic drama asks larger questions about personal agency, about personal effectiveness and responsibility, and it teases at the question of belief. To what extent does our belief system serve as a consoling narrative for the frightening mysteriousness of our own lives? What can we know about ourselves? What can we know about the people closest to us?
In Contemplation of Giant Questions, playwright Bruce Norris discusses the making of A Parallelogram with director Anna D. Shapiro and artistic director Martha Levy. I'm Dixie Uffelman, and I'll be reading Martha Levy.
I'm Paul Miller, reading Bruce Norris.
I'm Madeline Lambert, and I'll be reading Anna D. Shapiro.
The inquiry in A Parallelogram is different from what is explored in a lot of your other plays. Not that they don't all share similarities, but certainly The Pain and the Itch and The Unmentionables both very clearly are social critiques in a way that this play is not.
I would say the same applies to Clybourne Park, too. All three of those plays concern themselves with how people frame their social and political selves in language. I don't think that A Parallelogram is the same kind of play. I think it's a bit closer to The Infidel or, to some extent, Purple Heart. I think it is a return to a style of writing I was trying to pursue before 2000.
One of the things that those earlier plays share is a focus on an individual and his or her psychology.
I certainly didn't set out specifically to be a political satirist or a satirist of any kind. It just happened that over the last 10 years, the political situation in this country was so dire that it demanded this kind of play. I think that I felt a little relaxation in the last year and a half. Even though Parallelogram precedes the current administration, I knew the old administration was leaving.
When you are writing a play like A Parallelogram, what does it do for your presiding consciousness while you're in the work process?
It makes me uncomfortable to try to write a play like A Parallelogram. My instinct is to try to point towards things in society that are stupid and to laugh. I don't think that's what I'm doing in A Parallelogram. I'm trying to frame something I think about and to have characters discuss it in a way that makes some sense to me, even if I haven't succeeded in fully articulating that through these characters. It has been a different process for me than my usual finger-pointing.
When we started working together at Steppenwolf 13 years ago in 1997, in that time a lot has happened in our lives. How do you experience that as a playwright? Is it harder or easier to write plays now?
Harder, because there's a better sense of what's good and bad, and what there is to like in your own writing. Earlier on, there isn't as much self-judgment.
We have this repeated conversation where Bruce will say to me, "I'm afraid I'm just in the same trope." And then I will say, "Didn't Chekhov talk about the same thing?" We have this mantra-like conversation every couple of years where he gets alarmed that he is revisiting in a way that is not new. My argument, and I think that I am right, is that he is in contemplation of giant questions. And I don't know that even if he wrote 20 plays, he'd be done.
I absolutely agree that Bruce brings a richness to each of his visitations in his work. But there is something sickening to experience in oneself. Oh my God, me again.
It's horrible. It's Wally Shawn's question. Why can't I wake up tomorrow and not be me? Every morning I wake up and I'm here again. It's a horrible thing to have to confront. The director's experience is somewhat different from the writers and the actors, who both deal with their own material all the time. Actors don't get to direct the other actors or choose what the scenery looks like. They're just dealing with themselves. They don't get the kind of periodic refreshment that you feel, Anna, when working on a play.
I think that's right.
I am very fortunate because I have another job, but certainly being in Endgame, I was reminded of something I've thought of in the last number of years, that acting is a kind of death rehearsal because of the routine and ritual of it. Which is actually beautiful because one can be feeling physically shot, but along comes half hour, 15, and you're fine. Inhabiting a physical and verbal text with finality night after night has something to do with what we're talking about.
I think so, too. From what I observe, there's an erasing of self that has to happen to actors for short little bursts of time, and it can either add up to something that helps you, depending on the time of your life, or add up to something that's problematic.
With playwriting, where one is in the progress of one's own life certainly has an impact on the vision of the play or its expression. How did A Parallelogram arrive in its form?
When I was writing The Infidel, I was coming out of a period of crisis in my life that involved a sense of recalibration about where I was going to wind up, how I would land on my feet, and so forth. That influenced what kind of play I wrote. Similarly, in writing this play, I think I was coming to the end of a cycle of writing a certain kind of play, and I was at a loss as to what to do next. I was also going through some personal life stuff that put me back into contemplation of certain questions. And those questions always lead to a contemplation of something more finite than a satirical play would point to.
What do you mean finite?
More life and death questions than life questions and the manner of living. That's what I think satire addresses, the manner of living.
Can you describe what the construct of A Parallelogram is?
I want to be sure I don't give anything away about the play, but I also want to say that it is in the mind of the person who is talking about the parallelogram in the play, B. There is a notion that she has constructed for herself, that because of the physical construction of the universe, all moments of her life are accessible to her at any given moment. All moments of her life are going on simultaneously. She could be in conversation with herself as a child or in conversation with herself as a very old person.
Bruce, why do you think it is important to receive the play without any information?
I think it is delightful for an audience to be surprised by hearing a story for the first time. My father was a big fan of the TV show Columbo. He liked it because they paid attention to what the audience was watching. There were clues scattered throughout, and if you could add up the clues, you could figure out what was going on along with Lieutenant Columbo. I feel like that aspect, even if we're talking about Hamlet, you find out things about Hamlet as you watch it. Unfortunately, when you see Hamlet now, you've probably already read it or seen it before, so you can't have that experience of newness anymore. That is one of the thrilling things for me in seeing a play for the first time. You get to learn a new story.
I remember when Anna was directing The Crucible here. She just happened to be sitting behind a couple of young girls on a preview night. They'd never seen The Crucible before, and when the doll came out, they screamed. I remember you saying that you couldn't watch the show because you were so delighted watching them.
There are two different kinds of people in the world in terms of the way this play could be looked at. People who wish certain things could happen, and people who know certain things can't. I am really interested to see what people think just happened. It's going to be really fun to talk to people about a Bruce Norris play and not be having a political conversation, but having an emotionally revelatory one where you go, "Wow, I didn't know that about you."
I don't want to say that there is nothing political in the play at all, because there is a political dimension to the play, but it interlaces with the personal in a different way.
Exactly. Because it interlaces with the personal, you do not get to stand back and have a detached conversation about it. Which side are you on in the group is a different discussion than, "What did you just see?"
You can talk about the issues in Bruce's other plays without self-indictment. You could say, "Oh, those people and these people." I think if you are talking about the issues in A Parallelogram, you're going to pretty quickly ask, "What actually do I think about my own death?"
Chances are pretty good that everyone has to come to confront their own death at some point, unless they're lucky enough to be shot in the head before they knew they were going to be. Uncovering Illusion in the Work of Bruce Norris, by literary apprentice Marty Lyons. A Parallelogram is something of a departure for playwright Bruce Norris. For audience members encountering his work for the first time, a comparison with two earlier plays might help to illuminate this one. For audiences who saw Steppenwolf's productions of The Pain and the Itch in 2005 and The Unmentionables in 2006, this article provides a useful recollection. It's almost as if Norris's earlier plays are a call and a parallelogram is the response. The questions in this play might even be read as counterpoints to those of The Pain and the Itch and The Unmentionables. Here Norris seems to ask, what do we do after we know the truth about ourselves? If we rid ourselves of all self-deception, how well can we function in the world? Is some self-protective illusion useful? The Pain and the Itch and The Unmentionables, by contrast, involve characters who are involved with the struggle to find the truth in the first place about themselves and their lives. If you saw either production, you probably wouldn't associate Norris's devastating satire with the popular 1970s TV series Columbo, starring Peter Falk, clad in a dingy raincoat, or any other serial TV detective show. Yet in an interview given for this program, Norris counts the detective drama among his artistic influences. My father was a big fan of the TV show Columbo. He liked it because they paid attention to what the audience was watching. There were clues scattered about, and if you could add up the clues, you could figure out what was going on with Columbo. Indeed, when you take a second look, the comparison between the TV series and Norris's work is apt. Although the acerbic tone of The Pain and the Itch and The Unmentionables bears little in common with The Adventures of Columbo's Detective, both of Norris's earlier plays contain mysteries at their core, and each is propelled by that genre's inexorable drive to uncover the truth. In classic mystery style, riddles multiply over the course of both plays. In The Pain and the Itch, these include, has 4-year-old Caleb been the victim of sexual abuse? Is the family's maid trustworthy or a thief? What creature has been secretly gnawing on the family's food? The Unmentionables also contains mysteries. Who is responsible for the recent firebombing of a missionary school? Is the actress-turned-schoolteacher Jane genuinely ill? What happened to Dave, the missionary in charge of the school? Was his disappearance the result of foul play? Anxiety over these unanswered questions builds through both plays, and we know our evening will not end until the truth is uncovered. While detectives like Columbo are motivated by a passionate desire to uncover the truth about others, Norris's characters hunt for culprits to avoid facing painful truths about themselves. In The Pain and the Itch, Clay accuses the family's innocent maid of abusing his daughter. We later realize this comes from his own desperate need to deny the failure of his marriage. In The Unmentionables, Dave interrogates Jane relentlessly about the legitimacy of her illness. Later, we realized his aggressiveness is born out of fear about the truth of his own sexuality. Despite the search for scapegoats, Norris's detectives are ultimately forced to acknowledge their own hypocrisies. As their self-deceptions are shattered, these characters must acknowledge that their justifications for their behaviors are just that, justifications. They are forced to abandon their romantic self-images and recognize the truth, as related succinctly by one character. See, they feel bad because what they practice doesn't square with what they preach, which makes them every bit as bad as the materialistic barbarians they despise. And you want to say to these people, hey, you don't have to change what you practice. That's way too hard. Just change what you fucking preach, spoken by Cash from The Pain and the Itch. The way these characters view themselves is disconnected from the way in which they live their lives. In The Search for a Scapegoat, Norris's characters first try to condemn other people, and finally come to painful self-knowledge. Despite the associated pain that comes with self-knowledge, we're left with the strong sense that coming out of self-deception offers the characters the opportunity to begin more authentic lives. A parallelogram represents for Norris a departure from the satiric indictments of these earlier works. In a way, this play picks up where the others left off. B's depressed lethargy at the beginning of a parallelogram mirrors Clay and Jane's exhaustion. Before the play begins, B has discovered that some of her life's aspirations are no longer possible and has yet to find a self-narrative to replace them. To make matters worse, the character of B2 quickly shoots down any attempt to create an optimistic vision of her future. At the beginning of the play, we have at least a partial version of the understanding that only emerges at the end of the earliest plays, and the result seems to be paralysis. In The Unmentionables and The Pain and the Itch, we learn the dangers of self-protective illusions. A parallelogram seems to explore the dangers of life without them. Thinking Ahead, Everyday Psychics and a Parallelogram, by artistic apprentice Rebecca Stevens. B, the central character in Bruce Norris's A Parallelogram, believes she can see the future. She is not alone. Around the globe, there are people who believe in the power of their own psychic predictions and share them with others, largely on the Internet. Last year, About.com capitalized on this trend by soliciting readers of a paranormal phenomena for predictions about 2010. While contributors made the occasional prediction based on current events, quote, the unemployment rate will drop to 8.5% by June, end quote, the majority were specific, ominous, and occasionally bizarre. A minor electrical fire will cause an office building in a major U.S. city to evacuate mere moments before a terrorist attack brings down the whole building. Mount Rainier is due to blow its top on July 7th. They will discover Bigfoot in Seattle woods. But consider this. The Carter administration successfully used government-employed psychics to locate a downed spy plane that satellites could not find. For years, Rhode Island Senator Claiborne Pell, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, retained a special assistant for supernatural research, fearful that scientists from the Soviet Union would make advances in the field. Police departments from Los Angeles to Chicago continue to consult clairvoyants to assist in murder cases. History is full of small moments of foresight. Researchers of parapsychology have recorded stories of survival when disaster is unthinkably avoided. A trolley conductor in Los Angeles who instinctively pulled his emergency brakes at a location he had dreamed he would crash and narrowly avoided hitting a swerving car. Or painful realizations of earlier warnings when disaster strikes. A little girl who told her mother she would die the night before she perished in the 1966 mining disaster of Aberfan, Wales. Though we may be unsure whether to believe these stories are indelible proof or complete scam, our interest in them persists. The belief that individuals can see the future has existed for centuries. The Oxford English Dictionary cites the word prophet from Old French in the 10th century as a divinely inspired person who speaks in the name of God. The connection with divinity was dropped by the 15th century to a prognosticator, a forecaster. In 1862, the phrase Prophet of Doom arrived, authored by William Cox Bennett in a poem entitled To My Watch. By 1892, New England Magazine borrowed the phrase to describe Parker Pillsbury, a fervent abolitionist and women's civil rights activist. While prophets today no longer hold prominent positions in our government and culture, our curiosity lingers. The British Premonition Bureau and the Central Premonition Registry in New York City, both established in the late 1950s, formed to collect and screen early warnings of disaster. Both eventually closed due to bad press and lack of funds. Both Freud and Jung were members of the Society for Psychical Research in the UK. The Rhine Research Center, a statistical and lab approach to understanding ESP, and the Arlington Institute are the most recent institutions devoted to the study of consciousness, including precognition. Moreover, human conception of time has proven to be inaccurate. As Einstein stated, for us faithful physicists, the separation between past, present, and future has only the meaning of an illusion through a persistent one. Perhaps we could have access to and knowledge of events in our future if only we understood how time truly functions. Can we know the future in advance? Our search to prove the authenticity or falsehood of premonition may only prove what we believed at the outset. Testing shows that the stronger an individual's beliefs in the potential of parapsychology, the better he or she performs on ESP tests. In the end, whether or not we can see into the future may rest on the strength of our own beliefs.
Security to the fifth floor nurse's station.
Unfreezing the Play by Director of Artistic Development Polly Carl. Theater is a series of ongoing interpretations. The playwright, director, dramaturg, designers, and actors come together in a collaborative process seeking a multitude of possibilities for the presentation of a play. At some point, in order to bring in the audience, the play freezes. The script is finalized, the set is built, sound and lights are programmed, and the actors find their rhythm. But the possible meanings of the play go on in post-show discussions, drinks after the play, and late-night pillow talk. My hope is to provide some heat to your conversations when you leave the theater, to thaw what we've temporarily frozen and invite you to collaborate in making meaning and theater with us. If someone could tell you in advance exactly what was going to happen in your life and how everything was going to turn out, and if you knew you couldn't do anything to change it, would you still want to go on with your life? B, in a parallelogram. Embedded in this central question in Bruce Norris's A Parallelogram is a consideration of the most fundamental of American values, a stalwart belief in self-determination, a vision of the self in which we make life happen. It doesn't just happen to us. In an America made up of self-made individuals, B's question challenges an American understanding of freedom that presupposes we have an innate ability to change our circumstances. Consider NPR's This American Life episode entitled My Brilliant Plan. The program consists of three episodes, each a story of an individual plan to overcome or control what are seemingly impossible situations, to cheat the possibility that fate has the final word. Of the three stories in the episode, the plan that most resonates with my revengeful Italian heritage is one where a man goes to buy a tombstone for his two sons. He has their pictures and dates of birth and death. They died on the same day. The funeral home director offers his condolences and wonders as to what terrible tragedy befell these young men. The man says, "Oh, they're both still alive, but they cheated me, so they're dead to me." The story, however, that connects so beautifully to the ideas of a parallelogram is a story about a man, Ron, who since age 11 has been trying to build a time machine. The father he idolizes drops dead from a heart attack when he is a young boy, and through the cartoon version of H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, Ron begins to imagine a scenario upon which he travels back in time to warn his father of his oncoming heart attack. He wants to tell his father that he has to quit smoking, change his diet, and take better care of himself. Ron's interest in time travel becomes an obsession when in college he reads Einstein and learns time can be changed by motion, that time can be changed. Ron will make it his life's work to try and change time. A parallelogram is also a story of time travel, a continual rewind, play, forward, rewind, that asks us to question our impulse to make brilliant plans. The play is framed by impending and realized disasters, natural disasters being the best proof of the fragility of the self-determination narrative. Jay references George Eliot's The Mill on the Floss, where a brother and sister die in a flood. B asks, "If there was an earthquake tomorrow in Bangladesh and a million people died, would you really care?" B and Jay go on a vacation marred by the drowning of a local fisherman. Finally, we know a tropical bird virus looms. Although these disasters mostly live in subtext, the various versions of B are defined by an uncontrollable sense of fate, the things that will happen to us despite our best efforts. A parallelogram offers up an excellent meditation on self-determination. If time itself is an uncertainty, then the very idea that we can rely on ourselves to drive life forward, make changes, and have an impact is a precarious philosophy at best. In this American Life's My Brilliant Plan episode, we are left to wonder about the outcome of the best laid plans. Will building a grave marker for his sons allow the father to move on with his life? We do know that Ron never made it back in time to warn his father, but we also know that Ron earned a PhD, became a physicist, and ultimately his ideas about time travel have become respected by many great scientific minds. Bryce Dewitt, one of Einstein's contemporaries, commented to Ron after he presented his plans for time travel, "You may never see your father again, but I'm certain he would be proud of you." For Ron, this sentiment ultimately made his brilliant plan worth it.